Hi, podcast listeners. Today, I'm drilling down on the rise of white nationalism after another shooting at an American synagogue. Then, fascinating to hear Yascha Mounk say that the recent Spanish elections show no country is safe from rising populism and nationalism. And I speak to a 26-year-old co-founder of the climate activist organization, the Sunrise Movement. She's engaged, passionate, and determined to make a change with the Green New Deal. Walter speaks to the award-winning actor Alec Baldwin about what it takes to impersonate President Trump and why he's even considered running for the Oval Office. So enjoy the show. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Once again, a domestic terrorist attacks worshippers at an American synagogue. And today, his victim is being laid to rest. Lori Gilbert Kay was killed at the Chabad of Poway Synagogue near San Diego on Saturday. She had come to services to say memorial prayers for her mother and was shot while trying to protect her rabbi and friend, Yisrael Goldstein. Here, the rabbi, also injured in the attack, describes his own encounter with the shooter.
I turn around and I see a sight that I can't, undescribable. Here is a young man standing with a rifle pointing right at me. And I look at him. He had sunglasses on. I couldn't see his eyes. I couldn't see his soul.
The killer is allegedly a 19-year-old white man who apparently posted plans to kill Jewish people in an open letter online. And he references other recent attacks on places of worship, including the brutal assault on Muslims in Christchurch, New Zealand, and the killing of 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh 6 months ago. President Trump condemned the shooting and called Rabbi Goldstein personally to express his condolences. But after the New Zealand attack, Trump had dismissed the threat from white extremists, calling them a small group of people that have very serious problems. As a counterterrorism expert at the FBI, Michael German spent months undercover, infiltrating white supremacist and far-right paramilitary groups. He's now a fellow at the National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Michael German, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you must have been thinking about this a lot, especially in light of your undercover work and in light of the fact that synagogues in the United States are now being targeted. And the latest reports from the FBI are that these attacks have increased hate crimes by about 17% in the last look, and particularly against Jewish worshippers and Jewish people. It's up to 58% compared to about 19% when it comes to anti-Islamic attacks. What is going on?
Well, I think the big change is the sanctioning of this violence by people in authority. And obviously, we have President Trump, since he was a candidate, making anti-Muslim comments, anti-immigrant comments, comments that seem to speak to this audience. And so when a group like this has the idea that the government is supporting what they're doing, they can be much more active, much more public, much more violent. And so I think that the biggest difference that we're seeing today is not just that they're getting this sanction from the highest levels of our government, but that there is a lack of police enforcement of this violence.
So, Michael, sorry to interrupt you, but that's, you know, it's clearly an accusation and it's very controversial what you're saying. I mean, you're accusing, as you just said, the highest level of government of sanctioning this kind of violence. I mean, you know, you haven't heard the president say anything against the Jewish community. I understand with the travel ban and the other things against the Islamic community and et cetera, you know, there's a lot of heated rhetoric and very heated feelings. But why do you think it is that and not just a resurgence of anti-Semitism?
Well, keep in mind that according to the manifesto that was allegedly written by this the person who attacked the synagogue, he acknowledges that he had also attacked a mosque a month before. So you have to understand that these groups aren't just focused on one minority group. They're focused on any group that isn't white. And certainly the primary focus has long been against the Jewish populations. But since 9/11, it became much more mainstream to be able to criticize Muslims in a way that you couldn't criticize other groups. And that eventually was picked up on by these groups. And they use that animus to drive people towards their us versus them arguments. And how they defined us became very narrow. And when candidate Trump started running and was clearly defining who the us was and making all others the enemy and threatening to us, what this white supremacist community heard was that this person is supporting our way of thinking. And I don't believe that Donald Trump is a white supremacist, but the language he was using was giving fuel to the activities these groups were involved in.
So let me ask you, because you spent a considerable amount of time, as we said, undercover infiltrating some of these precise groups. At what period was that, and how did you see them evolve? What did you learn from that period of infiltration and undercover work?
So I was involved in an undercover operation targeting neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups based in Southern California in the early 90s, 92 to 93. And then after the Oklahoma City bombing in 96 and 97, I was undercover with militia groups in the Pacific Northwest. And what I learned going into the white supremacist group is that their philosophies and ideologies and sometimes theologies aren't some strange creation that is not common to our history. You know, in fact, white supremacy has been a large part of the European colonization of the world, including the U.S. And the theories and religious interpretations justified slavery. They justified genocides. They justified later Jim Crow. They justified all kinds of discriminatory actions against non-white peoples. And those ideas were pushed to the margin through the civil rights movement, but they never actually went away.
Okay.
And this history informs what's going on now.
Well, let me drill down on some of these figures, because the Anti-Defamation League says that, you know, between 2009 and 2018, 73% of extremist killings in the United States were carried out by white supremacists. And yet the FBI says that only 900 of its 5,000 open investigations into terrorism are focused on domestic terrorists. You said at the beginning there's a problem with law enforcement in this particular area of domestic terrorism, the white supremacists. Why is that? Why do we see these figures of disparity here?
Well, I'd keep in mind the 900 domestic terrorism cases don't all involve far-right militants. That includes environmentalists. The FBI, starting in 2004, said eco-terrorism was the number one threat. It involves numerous other groups. So we don't know directly how many of those cases are actually focused on far-right violence, but we know that by policy, the Justice Department deprioritizes far-right violence.
And why is that?
It's a matter of policy.
But why?
Something that they could change tomorrow.
But why?
Your guess is as good as mine. Your guess is as good as mine. And it's recent, right? In the 1990s, I worked my undercover cases off the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. There was nobody at the Justice Department, nobody at the FBI, who were claiming we didn't have federal laws that justified our investigations. This is a recent argument that the Justice Department has been making, that they don't have enough domestic terrorism laws. So we put out a report at the Brennan Center last year that showed there are actually 51 federal laws of terrorism and a 52nd law banning material support toward the commission of any of those acts of terrorism. Mm-hmm. Plus, there are 5 federal hate crime statutes. Plus, there are all kinds of organized crime statutes that are often used against any racist group that's involved in this kind of violence.
Well, let me ask you this, though, because what's really it looks like there, just to follow up on what you're saying, there's been a political pushback. In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security wrote a report outlining the resurgence of extremism in America. And it was leaked, apparently, according to a senior analyst, to conservative media. Republican lawmakers demanded the report be rescinded due to its use of the term right-wing extremism. So there was a political pushback even against the term. Is that something you know about, you can corroborate?
Yes, that certainly was a problem. Now, I worked at the ACLU at the time, and I criticized that report as well because it was very overbroad in the way it described the groups and the way it made a causal connection between people with ideas we don't like and people who are actually committing violence, where that connection is not really based in empirical studies. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely true that this is a political issue. I mean, why the FBI would claim eco-terrorism was the number one threat when there isn't a single homicide related to the environmentalist movement in the last 20 years, certainly. And as far as I've looked back, it's hard to find any. So this is a political calculation the Justice Department has made that we can deprioritize far-right violence. And part of the way they do that is by, you know, Congress has done its job. It passed a definition of domestic terrorism that is very simple and easy to apply when describing these cases and prioritizing them. The problem is the Justice Department doesn't follow that definition and instead has created its own. And they call most of the far-right violence hate crimes, which is fine because hate crimes also come with severe penalties. Problem is the Justice Department defers investigation and prosecution of these crimes to state and local law enforcement, and only 12% of law enforcement agencies across the country actually report hate crimes. Mm-hmm. So there's this broad gap where we don't even know the number of homicides committed by far-right militants because nobody collects that data. Mm-hmm. And groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center and some academic groups try to go out and collect this information, but they're reliant on law enforcement identifying these crimes as biased crimes, and they're dependent on the media covering them because they're hard to, it's hard to go to every courtroom in the United States and to look at every case. Not to mention, half of the violent crime in the United States isn't solved. That includes 40% of the homicides. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're looking at this violence, it's important to keep in mind this is a tiny fraction of the violence that the Americans suffer every year. So we have to put it in context and understand it as part of a larger problem of violence in this country. And I think that's the key, the first part of how we start addressing it. And the second part is understanding that the victims of this violence are who need support, yeah. Right? Most hate crimes laws, most terrorism laws are extraordinarily punitive. You know, decades in prison, death penalty involved in these things, where if we understand that the injury is against the community and start to choose to use restorative justice measures that are about bringing our communities together, that will have a better long-term outcome for security in the United States.
Well, it's certainly troubling. We'll keep an eye on it. Michael German, thank you so much indeed for joining us on this issue. Now, where do these actions fit in, if at all, with recent waves of nationalism and populist parties in Europe? Is this phenomenon still on the rise or is it playing itself out? In Spain this weekend, parliamentary elections saw a far-right party win seats for the very first time since the fall of the fascist dictator Francisco Franco back in 1975. The extreme nationalist Vox Party, that is Latin for voice, fell a bit short, though, of predictions, but still managed 10% of the vote. The centre-left Socialist Workers' Party, a mainstream one, won most seats. It made a stronger showing than usual, but with no outright majority, it'll have to find coalition partners. So what should we take away from these results? The political scientist Yasha Munk writes often about populism and democracy, and he's joining me now from Baltimore, where he is associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Yasha Munk, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Christiane.
I wonder what you, because you've been studying this a lot, what's going on in Europe, and obviously what's happening in the United States as well in a slightly different way. But what do you make of what happened in Spain over the weekend? And does it have sort of lessons or predictors for what might happen in some of these other countries with far-right parties?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first very important lesson from the election in Spain is simply that no country is safe from the rise of populism and no country is safe from the rise of far-right populism. I grew up in Germany, and when I was traveling in the country in the fall of 2016, I spoke to a number of senior politicians who said, even though the Alternative for Germany is doing very well in polls right now, I can't imagine that they will ever be in the Bundestag, because our history has made us immune from those kinds of far-right parties. And the Spanish elites thought very much the same thing. Because of the recent history of fascist rule in the country, because of the pride in having transitioned to democracy, it just wasn't imaginable that an openly far-right country, far-right party, would gain a real foothold in their political system. Well, unfortunately, the AfD did gain a large number of seats in the German Bundestag a couple of years ago, and now Vox has gained a large number of seats in the Cortes Generales in Madrid. So I think the first important lesson is simply that this kind of far-right populism can break through anywhere and no country is immune from it.
But put it in perspective, because, you know, we started by saying it fell slightly short of some of the predictions with the exit polls. It hasn't done as well, but is it still a threat, do you think? And what are its main politics, its main plank?
Mm-hmm. Well, its main plank is to make Spain great again, which is a phrase obviously borrowed from the American president, Donald Trump, but perhaps with an even more sinister resonance in a country where General Franco did rule less than 50 years ago. It is anti-immigrant, for immigration is less of an issue in Spain because the country has had a little bit less immigration than many other European countries. It is quite hardcore on gender issues. It is very upset about some of the social transformations and greater gender rights, greater LGBTQ rights that the country has embraced in the last few years. And it is interestingly quite neoliberal on the economy. So unlike some other populist parties across Europe, that essentially want a kind of form of welfare state chauvinism, where you expand the welfare state, but only for the true, quote-unquote, real citizens of a country. Vox actually wants a pretty hardcore neoliberal set of economic policies. Is it dangerous? Well, I think, first of all, it is dangerous that a nostalgia for the past, including a soft paddling at best of the fascist past, now has an institutionalized voice in Spain. The mainstream center-right party, the Partido Popular, had always embraced some of those voters, but without ever letting them run the show. The fact that they now have to compete with Vox is likely to lead to an even greater move towards populist modes, towards populist politics among the center-right in Spain, mm-hmm. As we've already seen in countries like Austria, for example. And that's quite concerning for the years to come.
So just to link it back to the United States, obviously Make Spain Great Again, as you pointed out, is a direct, transplant from the United States. But also Steve Bannon, who is sort of credited with being the super nationalist, the super populist disruptor, has met with a lot of these groups in Europe, including Vox. Explain the linkage and what sense it makes for American parties to be aligned or to try to support these kinds of parties in Europe.
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's important not to exaggerate the role that Steve Bannon plays in all of this. He goes around to all these countries and he meets with all of these people. And certainly it's interesting to see whom he endorses. And he very strongly endorsed the Vox party in Spain, which gives you a sense of the ideological profile. I don't know how personally influential Steve Bannon was on the Vox party in Spain, or how important he is in this whole story. Rather, it seems to me to be a story of ideological convergence. I think that there is a similar rebellion going on in North America and in Western Europe against immigration, against social liberalization, against a greater role of women in society, against LGBTQ rights. And the different movements that embrace that brand of politics naturally have a lot in common. And so, you know, they might meet every now and again. They might enjoy the publicity that comes with mutually endorsing each other and so on. But I think essentially it is a parallel reaction to similar underlying drivers in society.
Let's just talk about a couple of issues that have come up recently. You used to talk, certainly in your book, you talked about how, you know, young people in the United States and elsewhere are sort of nostalgic for a quote-unquote strongman president or leader. And there's been just a recent report here in the UK by the Hansard Society this year about attitudes towards democracy, with 72% saying the system of government needs quite a lot or a great deal of improvement. 54 says Britain needs a strong leader willing to break the rules. And 47% feel they have no influence at all over national decision making. Do you see that sort of gaining traction, or is that sort of the height of the populist wave?
Well, I think that's always difficult to know. It's the same in the stock market. You can see that a stock has risen and risen and risen, that might predict that it's going to continue to rise, or you may be looking at its peak. I don't think anybody quite knows. I fear that populism is going to continue to grow because it is reacting to a set of underlying drivers, changing demographics, the changing role of different minorities in society, but also economic stagnation and a sense that governments no longer deliver for ordinary people. And combined with the rise of social media, which makes it easier for extremist voices to gain a real foothold in politics, I think that makes a very dangerous cocktail, and that's not about to change. At the same time, it's absolutely possible that people will start to look at some of these populist movements and governments and say, I'm not quite sure they're delivering for us either. And of course, you may see the rejuvenation of some mainstream parties. In that sense, the Spanish election, I think, had one good piece of news, which is that the center-left, sensible PSOE that has given real benefits to ordinary citizens, including a rise in living standards, that had a strong, relatively young candidate who's clearly quite competent, managed to increase its result, gain nearly 30% of the vote. So it's definitely possible that we might be at the height of this trend, but I wouldn't jump to that conclusion quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, certainly was interesting to see what you've just pointed out about that centre-left party. We're just going to put up a map of the sort of share of populist parties since 2017, to ask you, the upcoming European elections are going to be quite significant, aren't they? Well, what do you expect to be the picture? Would it be much the same as the one we're seeing now? I know you can't see it, but there's quite a big share of populist parties, in all these European countries. Do you think it's going to get more acute with these elections at the end of May?
Yeah, look, populism is still something that we think of as this marginal force, as this insurgent force, but it's now one of the absolutely dominant political forces across the world. I just arrived this morning in Baltimore from Brazil, which now has a populist government, as do three of the largest democracies in the world. And I traveled recently across some of that map, from Szczecin in the north of Poland to Trieste in Italy, along the lines of the old Iron Curtain, never leaving a country that is ruled by populists, through Poland and Hungary to Austria and Italy. So this is a very important political force in Europe now. And so it will gain a lot of support in the European Parliament elections as well. The estimates vary. I think about a third of the vote is likely to go to populist parties. That's in line with recent elections at the national level. And that certainly will allow populists on the right to be a very important roadblock to sensible governance at the European Union level and to the very real reforms that the EU definitely needs. I would like to emphasize, though, that it's sort of odd that normally media outlets have ignored European Parliament elections. They've seemed completely irrelevant. That underestimated how important the European Parliament has become. I slightly fear that this year we are throwing all of our attention too strongly on the European Parliament elections, because even though the parliament is certainly important, the national level remains the most important in Europe.
Yep.
And probably the most important election that we have coming up is in Poland this fall, in which the opposition will try to displace a government that is attacking democratic institutions in very, very acute ways. And if that government is reelected, I fear that we will have a rising dictatorship in the heart of Europe in Warsaw, just as we already do in Hungary, for example.
It's really so interesting and important to keep our eye on. Yasha Monk, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, one issue that is set to be key in upcoming elections around the world is climate. In the last few months, we've seen more and more young people take to the streets demanding that politicians sit up and take notice of the climate crisis. One such group in the United States is the Sunrise Movement. The youth-led initiative has been working to put pressure on elected officials since they formed back in 2017. And a breakthrough came for them in November when 200 activists occupied the incoming Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office a week after the midterm elections. And they were paid a visit by their ally, freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In February, they again took their demands right to the door of another Democrat, Senator Dianne Feinstein, asking her to vote in favor of the Green New Deal. This is how the senator responded.
I've been doing this for 30 years. I know what I'm doing. You come in here and you say it has to be my way or the highway. I don't respond to that. I've gotten elected. I just ran. I was elected by almost a million vote plurality. And I know what I'm doing. So, you know, maybe people should listen a little bit.
Joining me now is the 26-year-old co-founder and director of the Sunrise Movement, Varshini Prakash. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you must feel pretty energized right now because we've had such a spotlight on, for instance, Extinction Rebellion for the last 2 weeks here in London. There's been the Greta Thunberg, movement. There's just so much now really focusing on the kind of things you've been calling for. Do you feel that this is a tipping point movement and moment?
Absolutely, I do. I mean, it has been incredible. We have been on this road to the Green New Deal tour right now. I am actually in California, Senator Feinstein and also Nancy Pelosi's state at this moment. Just yesterday, we met with dozens of people in Paradise, California, a place that has been reduced to rubble and metal and melted plastic because of the fires of last year. If you can imagine, people were quite literally fleeing with fires on both sides in their cars melting from the heat as they were trying to get to sanctuary, and they could not get out of the car because of the danger of the fires. So it's a place that is ground zero for climate change, and we are seeing that in the midst of that, young people are recognizing the political failures of our politicians over the last 30 years and stepping up to take action.
I just want to go back to your own personal story, because I think your grandparents were affected very, very traumatically by climate change in India, right?
Yeah, so my family is from southern India. They weren't directly impacted by the floods, but a few years ago, there were these terrible monsoon seasons that went all throughout southern India. And I saw these images of people walking miles to sanctuary in chest-deep water, seeing how people in my community who looked like me, families and friends, lost electricity for weeks, weren't able to have food or water. And it just sort of made me realize that this crisis is not 30, 40, 50 years in the future, like they say. It's impacting people in this moment. And we're seeing that not only in India, but we see it all across the domestic United States with the fires, but also the hurricanes that have devastated Maria, that have devastated Puerto Rico, like Hurricane Maria. 3,000 people who have perished, who still lack access to clean water and more. So we're really seeing the impacts all over. And that those floods in India was one of the key moments that made me step up and want to create Sunrise Movement to form a political vehicle for the millions of young people who are terrified right now about what our future holds.
Well, certainly the young people are showing all us previous generations up by their dedication and their activism and their single-minded political endeavors here. But what is exactly, I mean, can you actually say what the Green New Deal is? Because, yes, it does sound very FDR, and it's not a new term. Other groups and people have used that in the past. But there are many people who criticize it. You just saw Dianne Feinstein. You've heard Nancy Pelosi, because they say it's a bit woolly. It doesn't have specific economic proposals or parameters. What exactly is it as you see it?
Right. Well, I think before we get to the policies, we've got to get crystal clear on the vision and the goals. And the Green New Deal resolution put forward by Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey earlier this year did exactly that. And it calls for a 10-year economic mobilization at a scale that we haven't seen since perhaps World War II in America. It calls for getting America off of fossil fuels and stopping climate change, the creation of a massive labor force, tens of millions of good, high-paying jobs in the process, and the virtual elimination of poverty as well. So it's a program that really aims to tackle and address getting to climate action through achieving racial and economic equality and justice as well.
Okay, so look, I mean, these are all major issues that especially young people are, again, really on the sharp edge of all of this. You know, income justice, not just climate, but as you just mentioned, gender, sexuality, all of the issues that are really, really important. But again, I just trying to figure out, because some of the old graybeards and the people who've been at this for the longest, like James Hansen, was on a panel with you just recently on Al Jazeera, and he sort of poured cold water over the idea of the Green New Deal. Let me just play this.
The Green New Deal, as they've defined it, is nonsense. We need a real deal, which understands how economics works and what we need to do in order to move off of fossil fuels.
So, I mean, there you were in that picture with him. I mean, what was it like to have him say that it's nonsense? And again, do you feel some kind of pressure to articulate something much more focused?
Yeah. Yeah, I will admit I felt my breath catch at that moment. And I felt this huge disappointment to see somebody who, you know, I had looked up to, who had provided the first testament to Congress in 1988 about the climate crisis, come out and call the greatest hope that my generation has right now to stop the climate crisis nonsense and sort of repeat conservative talking points about it. So what I'll say is this Green New Deal has given young Americans so much hope. We support it in majorities, and even conservative Republicans agree that their own party is hugely out of line with what the rest of the world and really the rest of the public believes we need to do about this crisis. I think that the policy specifics are coming. There are a number of senators and congresspeople more broadly working on this. We're also seeing that presidential candidates are starting to roll out their policies, and that that climate change will be a central conversation to the 2020 election debates and the election cycle. But I think it's well on its way, and we have to start with the vision of where we're going. And what this resolution has provided is saying that the last 30 years of incrementalist policies, of weak tea policies and tepid proposals are not enough to prevent millions of lives being lost to pollution and to climate crisis.
You know, you mentioned that it's become a central plank of certainly the next presidential election, the Democratic candidates. Beto O'Rourke today unveiled a $5 trillion plan in which to have zero emissions by 2050, net zero. You've seen here in the UK, the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, is pushing a vote this week to decide to declare climate emergency following these extinction rebellions. And even the leader of Scotland, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is talking about a climate emergency. I mean, that's a lot of traction that you all have gained in a fairly short time.
Yeah, exactly. And we have seen an eruption in the United States as well. Just in the last 6 months, Sunrise Movement went from having just 20 local chapters to having over 200 in almost every single one of the states of the U.S. We have seen thousands of people take action. We have seen dozens of politicians co-sponsor this resolution by Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey. We have seen a majority of Democratic presidential contenders campaigning and championing a Green New Deal. And furthermore, we are seeing that people are really gearing up to make this a decisive issue every single day on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. So I'm infinitely hopeful. I think there are a lot of people who are organizing actively on the ground and mobilizing actively on the ground right now.
I mean, Vashni, I wonder whether you heard Michael German, former FBI, saying that not so long ago, eco-terrorism was considered a big domestic terrorism threat in the United States. I mean, we have come a long way since those days.
We have. And I mean, if you look at it, even the Department of Defense agrees that the number one issue, the greatest national security threat right now is climate change. Mm-hmm. So if we actually want to protect our nation, if we want to protect the world from engaging in war, from falling into chaos and violence, the greatest thing right now to do would be to embrace a Green New Deal and launch into this economic mobilization mm-hmm. program over the next 10 years.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much indeed, co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, for joining us. And next, we turn to our guest, the award-winning actor Alec Baldwin. In the past 3 years, he's become an even more familiar face by impersonating President Trump on Saturday Night Live. Baldwin's latest role is another larger-than-life character. Framing John DeLorean tells the story of the car executive best known for making the famous time-traveling vehicle in Back to the Future. Rocked by scandal, his company ultimately went bust, though. He joined our Walter Isaacson to talk about the biopic, how he gets in character to play President Trump, and why he's considered running to replace him.
Alec, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Walter.
Hey, opening Tribeca Film Festival with a John DeLorean sort of combination doc and film. Do you like John DeLorean as a character? I mean, he sort of fits into your... style.
Oh, no.
That was a compliment.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, I'll try to find a way to take it as a compliment. I'll work on that. But years ago when there was a, I'm not going to say a fever, but there was more of a fizz to doing a DeLorean film.
Yeah.
He called me. Huh. I got a phone call from John DeLorean, and he said, Alec, with that... that Michigan accent of his, he said, Alec, I'd like you to play me in the film. And I said, oh, my God, that would be great. And he was living, I think actually he had been put out of his New Jersey, his Bedminster estate, which is now Trump's golf course. That was DeLorean's home. That was DeLorean's home.
Wow.
And he was evicted from there because of his financial reversals, and he was wound up living in some other home near there. But I spoke to him on the phone about me playing him in a movie, which never came about. And now this came. And I think that I was intrigued by the hybrid of the doc footage and the reenactment footage. And I think that in terms of creating the character, it wasn't easy. Because to do DeLorean, who's taller than me, leaner than me, there was a prosthetic makeup job that might have taken 3 hours, mm-hmm. which we couldn't afford that time-wise. So we came up with something with the best makeup artists that I know who are also very quick, which are the Saturday Night Live people.
When I first saw some clips of this, I saw John DeLorean unveil the car, and it took me a while to realize it was you. Let's look at a clip of this.
I know that we may be the new boy on the block, but I also know that on this, the bicentennial of the American Revolution, we can start making our version of the American dream a reality. Allow me to introduce the first incarnation in the evolution of my dream, our first vehicle, codenamed the DMC-12, the DeLorean motor car.
I love movies because there's so much practicality involved. So in order to have everything work in that shot, we had two men crouched down on the floor of the car who opened the gull wing doors on cue. And Morena Baccarin, who plays Christina Farrar, his wife at the time, is fantastic in the movie. And she's a wonderful actress. And Josh Charles is playing the other part
of it. And he has an incredibly driven character. He had cocaine problems, everything else. When you do a biopic like that, do you see how the personality all weaves together and it's sort of all part of one guy?
DeLorean's story is difficult to me to grasp because it's kind of an unresolved story. You know, DeLorean himself... he never actually came clean about why he did some of the things he did. He was a kind of a very furtive and very kind of a cagey animal who evaded prosecution for the. He beat the system in the cocaine charge. I think he was somebody who had an almost paralyzing allergy to failure. There was no way he was going to fail. So to go and get the funds from selling drugs and and the other crimes he committed, because there's a lot of things about DeLorean people don't know, other things he did that were kind of larcenous or exploitative of people.
So the crimes, in a way, explain what they were somewhat part and parcel of his personality.
Well, I guess a jury eventually, if I have it right, a jury eventually saw that, recognized that DeLorean was entrapped in a drug deal. Mm-hmm. And they went and got all this cocaine. They were going to move and access money to help bail out the failing project. Now, the project, if the story is told properly, the project, what he wanted to do, there was a lot of good things about that car company. He was going to, they were creating jobs in Ireland, and they were going to manufacture a car. One of the things that was the most surprising to me was how anemic the car actually was as a sports car. Mm-hmm. They were in a hurry to get this thing. Once they got the money and once they had delivery dates and so forth, it's a business with a timeline. They didn't have time to put the right engine in the car. So if I'm not mistaken, they got a six-cylinder Lotus that fit the body. They did it backwards. They did the body first and the engine after that. And the car was like a power-wise was, I mean, it wasn't a golf cart, but it was not much more. It was just a little bit more than that. And many people thought that the car, like DeLorean himself, looked beautiful on the outside and was very insubstantial on the inside.
When I watch you do John DeLorean, right. I think of you really getting into character. And the one, of course, that you do now, when you're so into the character, is Donald Trump.
So I'm basically taking military money so I can hasball. So I'm going to sign these papers for emergency, and then I'll immediately be sued, and the ruling will not go in my favor, and then I'll end up in the Supreme Court, and then I'll call my buddy Kavanaugh, and I'll say it's time to repay the Donnie, and he'll say, new phone, who dis?
When you get into Donald Trump, I mean, do you still enjoy it? Because it's so fresh every time you're on Saturday Night Live doing it.
Well, you know, you have it's such a dichotomy, the people's response. I mean, I have people, you know, the majority of people who will meet me are very kind, and they say, I love what you're doing, and they walk up and whisper to me, and they're very polite, and they say, thank you so much for helping us get through this nightmare and so forth. And then there's people typically online who are far away, who say, you know, you suck and you're the worst impersonator I've ever seen in my life and what have you. But truly, I thought that the thing about the cold opening on the show, which you are literally firing a cannon, it always ends with saying, live from New York on Saturday night. And whether whether your co-stars are members of the company, like Kate or Beck, or their other guest stars, like Ben Stiller or De Niro and so forth, there's a pace and there's a vitality to it that doesn't necessarily allow for the most precise Trump impersonation.
Right.
What we're doing is a figure of Trump. We're doing like an essence of Trump, his corrupt, amoral, mm-hmm. Machiavellian nature is at the fore, and doing a real Trump, that's for another project.
Well, in some ways, I mean, you're from Long Island, you grew up in this milieu, you kind of get Trump, it seems to me. I mean, do you feel that you really understand this guy?
No, I don't. I mean, I've said this before. For my podcast, I hosted an episode that we did with Michael Wolff, and it was at the crest of that Fire and Fury release of his book. And we were at town hall, and I remember saying for the first time, and I've said this a couple other times, that, you know, the presidency of the United States, which you know better than I do. I mean, you're an historian. You know better than I do. That this is a vista like no other vista in life. Mm-hmm. You have a job in which you see the kind of panoply of life, good and bad, what people are doing, including our own country, around the world, good and bad. And you meet the creme de la creme of society, thinkers, mm-hmm. athletes, artists, military men and women. You have a chance to see the world in a way that everybody that's had the job, this seat has changed them. Except Trump. Trump is the only man in American history that the presidency of the United States has had no effect on him whatsoever. It hasn't changed him. I thought he would change. After he won, which was horrifying to me, because if you're a New Yorker, you're on to Trump. He's not the host of The Apprentice who's fooled all these flyover Americans that he's this crack businessman. We kind of know that he's something else. But even so, when he won, I thought to myself, he's going to change. Give it a year and we'll see a different Trump. And no, He's the same now, which is, this is the real tragedy. He's exactly the same today as he was back in November of 2016.
You just talked about the flyover Americans, though. I mean, you must understand the resentment a lot of people feel in this country.
I do.
That leads to a Donald Trump.
When I say flyover Americans, I mean that that's a show business term in terms of demographics. I don't mean that with any in any pejorative sense. I mean, I live in a world where nobody watched The Apprentice. Mm-hmm. Nobody I know in the world I live in New York or L.A. or in the world I live in watched The Apprentice. Mm-hmm. The Apprentice was a tedious, kind of silly show that was on the air. That was a triumph for them and for Burnett and all those people. They made a lot of money. But the idea that you'd show an edited version of this kind of hyper-stylized reality show and say that that's who that guy is, this is acting. There was an article, which I'm sure you saw, that Larissa McFarquhar wrote in The New Yorker, all about Kentucky, and I think it was Kentucky or West Virginia, where she went down there. And that's what they were saying. They were saying, we don't necessarily support Trump or admire Trump, but we know how much you hate him.
Right.
Elites, Northeastern elites in their mind. And this is our chance to say, F you to the rest of the country, which I found numbing.
He has a lot of quirks in his way he looks and talks, and you've mastered them. I mean, it is, when you come on cold on Saturday Night Live, it's like you're doing John DeLorean. It just looks just like him. Show me some of the tricks. Just show me how you do it. You know, just what is it that makes you able to get into it?
What we do is a caricature. I mean, it's like an Oliphant drawing. You know,
right.
We don't really go for, it's like Steve Brodner. Everything is an exaggeration. But, the thing about Trump was, you just always look miserable. That was the key. Of your face, no matter what. So we would say, it's a beautiful day outside. Is it? Is it really beautiful? Outside, is it a beautiful day? Like, no, there's nothing people can say that can change you from this deep, deep, deep kind of unhappiness that I think he lives in all the time. Because it's just not going the way he imagined. How many people who've been president have been treated this way? I mean, even Reagan, liberals, Democrats, people who didn't agree with it, you know, they backed off. They didn't say unkind things and say, oh, well, he's got Alzheimer's. You know, they laid off out of some respect for the office, if not the man. George W. Bush, they started to give him a little bit more of the business because they thought that the illegitimacy of the election in Florida in 2000, I think, fueled some of that. But with Trump, I've never seen anybody that held this office be treated the way this guy is. It's uncanny.
Do you think the Democratic Party has gotten so jangled by Trump that they're in danger of fragmenting, going off the deep end, not having a real message that appeals to the people in America about where we should go next?
Well, I think Trump has had an effect on them, and perhaps a little bit more than your ordinary incumbent Republican. But, you know, I said recently online, I said, I'd love to run for president, and I viewed beating Trump as something that was easy to do. And I think that you need to have somebody come in and have a very tight message for the American people. Like if you come into the hospital and you break every bone in your body, but you punctured an artery, we have to fix the thing that's going to kill you first, and then we'll fix it. We'll set all your bones later. This country has to prioritize its needs. And there, let's say there's 10 things you want, but 5 things you need. And we must do the 5 things we need. First, health care, immigration, education, environmental protection, infrastructure. I mean, I've got my own list, but when you hear specific left-leaning Democratic candidates and progressive candidates talking about these buffet tables they want to set up of public policy without one word about how they're going to pay for it, that's what's going to kill the party in the next election.
So you seriously have thought about running. Might you actually think of doing this in the coming year?
Well, I want to be very clear that, I mean, I would love to. It's two things. One, I would love to be the president. And I think I would be a good president because I think I get it in terms of, the idea that there's things I don't know. Nearly all those men came into office and there's things they didn't know. I believe that there are people who are running for office that what they have that I don't have, I can get. Mm-hmm. But what I have that they don't have, they can't get, which is a worldview that the government has to move toward helping the greatest number of people. Now, do I think I would actually do it? Probably not, because it's so crowded now. And the media is kind of on board with right away anointing. This one sounds good. Here's a poll. This one's not doing so well. The game that the media does very often, which is that, and I think if I ran, they would kill me. They would just kill me. Even though a comedian who imitates the president just won the presidency of the Ukraine. That was very, that was very inspiring to me.
You've had an amazingly eclectic career.
Yes.
And I first became a fan when we were young, and I saw you play a streetcar named Desire on stage. You played, you know, Stanley Kowalski.
Right.
Got into that character.
Yeah.
Tell me about the arc of your career, because I think it may be the most eclectic career ever. Things from stage plays to game shows to softball player to podcaster to author.
You know, there was no plan in the sense that there's a way you can work in this business. And let's say it's not a long list, but there might be three or four things which are good advice if you want to succeed. I think that one of those things that I even tell people from time to time is don't become too politically outspoken. The people that are the biggest movie stars in the world today are people that you know nothing about their politics. It's very private. But to go and become very partisan and to go and become very vocal, attacking a president who has the support of some significant swatch of the country is always a risk. I mean, I've actually been fired from jobs. I've lost jobs.
You had the messy divorce with Kim Basinger and the fights over custody.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that?
What I learned, and I've told people before, is that when you're in court, be patient to let the bitterness leak out and to ebb. Because if you do what I did, and I mentioned this in the book, which is to win a ruling and then within months go back in and try to expand your ruling and antagonize the other side because they view the other party and their lawyers view it as a competition. Don't settle for the boilerplate you get and wait and just live with it for a year and a half, 2 years. You're entitled to more. You know you're entitled to more. But let the anger subside, and which I did not do. I went in every 3 months saying, I want my rights. You know, and you, what you realize is you don't have any rights as far as the court is concerned.
You talk about letting your anger subside. Did that help you manage, you know, you used to get in fights a whole lot, have anger problems and stuff. Has that helped you sort of with the family calm that down now?
And well, you know, this thing happened with this guy in front of my building where they said that I punched this guy. And what was really sad for me was there's cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I guess we're about to go maybe into some civil proceeding. I don't know. Because I feel badly in the sense that this guy's wasting his time and my time because there's cameras everywhere that dispute him. I mean, he lied to the police. If he says that I punched him in the face, that's a lie. But what I think is important is, number one, any physical altercation that you get into with people like that is not a good idea. But every single one of them I've had has been with a tabloid, paparazzi media member, and there was a provocation involved. I have never... I mean, I don't think I could survive in my business. I have never had an altercation with somebody in that quadrant of the media that wasn't provoked. If a guy's across the street with a long lens, I don't go running across the street and say, hey, what are you doing? But men who've come to my home during specific events in my life, and they almost chip my wife's teeth with the lens of a camera, you know, snapping it in her face. Anything like that where you get provoked and you cross a line, you lose. You're the loser.
What is your aspiration? What would be the great thing you'd love to do in a few years when you're ready to do something big?
Next year, in 2020, I will have done this for 40 years. Now, what I want to do, I don't know. My wife and I are thinking about maybe moving overseas for like a little holiday, like a year to live in Spain, because my wife is from Spain. We have all kinds of ideas of different things we might do because I'm 61. And I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 2-year-old, and an 11-month-old. So I want to make the most of the time I have left. And as my friend said, when I turned 60, he said, remember that you still have plenty of time, but none to waste.
Alec Baldwin, wow, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
and none to waste indeed, and whether he changes his mind about running for president or decides to retire into the Spanish sunshine after such a long and illustrious career. This is surely not the last we're seeing of Alec Baldwin. And that is it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.